Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 317, I chat with Josh Lamore, VP of Technology and Ecosystem Development at Technicolor, about his company's work on high dynamic range. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded August 5th, 2016, for release on August 18th. Episode 317, Technicolor on HDR. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Epson's new EcoTank printers. With Epson's line of SuperTank all-in-one printers, you can print thousands of documents without running out of ink. EcoTank is loaded and ready to print when you are. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank to find out more. And by Corning. Corning's incredibly durable Thunderbolt and USB 3.0 optical cables are longer, thinner, lighter, and stronger. Go to Corning.com/TWiT to save up to $130 on their superior Thunderbolt optical cables. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek and editor of AVSForum.com. This week's guest geek is Josh Lamore. He is the VP of Technology and Ecosystem Development at Technicolor. Hey, Josh, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much for inviting me, Scott.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. I think we're going to have a great conversation today. I'm looking forward to it as well. Those of you who are logged in to watch live at live.twit.tv, you can join the chat room there or at irc.twit.tv, and you can post questions as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. Now, it always helps to put my screen name in your message. My screen name is my name, Scott Wilkinson, no dots or dashes or spaces. And then it shows up in a different color on my screen, makes it easier for me to find it. So, Josh, most of us have heard the name Technicolor, but I'm not sure how many people would actually be able to define what it is Technicolor does. So if we could start with just a little background on the company, how long it's been around. Give us a bit of history and background on Technicolor.
Absolutely. So a lot of people recognize Technicolor maybe from movies from a long time ago. The company actually just celebrated its centennial. So we just celebrated 100 years. We received
Wow, congratulations.
Star. Thank you very much. So we received a Hollywood Star in recognition of that.
The first company
to receive a star, the second entity outside of a person to receive a star. So that was very, very good honor to receive.
No kidding.
But over the years, Technicolor has actually grown more than that. We are no longer just a post-production facility. We actually are a technology company. We are a post-production company, as I mentioned before, and we are also a connected home company. So we are effectively an ecosystem company. We exist from end to end, from everything from content creation through distribution technologies, through enhancement technologies, all the way to the home, and where we are the second largest producer of set-top boxes, which is something very few people know.
Yeah, I wouldn't have guessed that. We actually have a graphic to show, number one, that kind of gives a few stats, which I think are pretty darn cool. Take us through a couple of these.
Absolutely. So, as you'll notice, these are kind of the three different business units that exist within the company. The technology group, which I myself am a part of, exists of research and innovation team that is located in Rennes, France, also located in Los Altos, California. And I'm actually based out of Los Angeles, California. So we are a global company. We do have multiple different locations for the different services we provide, the different work that we do. Our entertainment services company is probably the most widespread. With Hollywood major blockbusters, we touch about 70% of all the major productions every year. So we are involved in some way, fashion, or form. We are also the largest producer of discs in the world, producing over a billion DVD, Blu-ray discs every year.
And before you go on, let me ask you this. Have you now started getting into producing Ultra HD Blu-ray discs?
Absolutely. We actually pressed one of the very first Ultra HD Blu-ray discs in the marketplace. And our connected home division is number one in producing gateways for the home as well as set-top boxes. Typically, it's under a white label for a lot of the production or a lot of the distribution companies, pay TV operators you recognize. But we are heavily in that space. So our goal with any technology we produce is to help bridge the gaps between whatever content is being produced at the time and how and what's the best way to get it into the home and to consumers' hands.
Well, and that's what we're going to talk about today. I certainly can't remember seeing a Technicolor set-top box, but as you said, you make them and then other people put their name on them, right?
Absolutely. So if you were to get something from a DirecTV, they're going to want to label it as a DirecTV set-top box. But the guts, the way that it's designed, the build itself, all the hardware may have come from a Technicolor.
Mm-hmm. I noticed in that slide we just saw the name Comcast. And I know that Comcast recently announced its set-top box called XI-5. Is Technicolor behind that one, or is that somebody else?
So XI-5 is a different producer of the set-top box.
Different producer.
But we do work pretty heavily. So the XI-3 and the XID were projects that Technicolor worked on. So there is a lot that goes on with all these different distributors. They multi-source from different outlets for their set-top boxes. So there's always multiple different providers. And right now there are conversations going on around their next generation set-top box, the XI-6.
Right, right. And the reason I bring that up is that it's one of the first, as far as I know, cable set-top boxes to support high dynamic range or HDR. And so that's a very exciting thing for me to see HDR coming into the home in some manner other than streaming or Ultra HD Blu-ray. And there are still very few Ultra HD Blu-rays. There'll be more as time goes on. But just the greater penetration of HDR into the home is a good thing, in my opinion.
Yeah, my opinion as well. We have definitely been part of the initial phases of rollout. Even for open standard HDR10 content, we worked with Amazon to help launch them to distributing HDR content, help them work together with them on the workflow to actually get the content made, as well as graded a significant amount of their original content that they have.
Mm-hmm. And that's what we're going to be talking about today in very short order. You're very involved. Technicolor is very involved in the creation and distribution of high def or high dynamic range content, I should say. Graphic number 2, I think, gives us a somewhat of a sense of that. So this is kind of an overview. So tell us what we're looking at here.
So graphic number 2 is actually a demonstration of different areas of technology that we've developed for the industry to help facilitate the open ecosystem, to help facilitate content being made and distributed. So we've recognized several different pain points in the marketplace. One of them, and maybe easily recognized as happened with the transition from HD to UHD, is you cannot create an ecosystem without content to fill it. So one of the first pieces that we have is something we call Technicolor ITM, which you'll see deployed in several different locations that allow us to do up conversion on standard dynamic range content, whether it's in the mastering process or in the live workflow or even in the set-top box or television down in the home, to help with facilitating the creation of the ecosystem that can then be filled with high quality content.
What it looks like here in this diagram is that you're really applying it to SDR, standard dynamic range content, and in order to up, as you say, up convert it. I probably would tend to prefer the word expand it to high dynamic range. And that in itself is a real challenge. I mean, A, it's important because that's what most content is right now, at least for the home. It'll get more and more native, but for the moment, it's mostly standard dynamic range. So we need some way to expand that into high dynamic range in a good way, in some reasonable way that doesn't look like dynamic mode, right? I mean, you buy a TV and I always say, don't put it in dynamic mode. It'll be too bright. It'll be too colorful. But that's sort of what HDR is, isn't it?
Well, to some extent. I mean, the upconversion technology we've developed is very much with an eye towards maintaining the creative intent in this new space. So different than dynamic mode, not trying to push over extreme saturation or over extreme brightness and contrast, but really trying to remain true to the creative intent within this new space. So it is giving it more pop. It is giving it more color, but it's still being faithful to the story that the creators wanted to tell.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another quick look at that graphic, because that, I think, is really quite illustrative of what we're talking about here. You've got content that you're creating or that you already have. You've got delivery, and finally, you've got display. And this ITM, which we're going to talk much more about shortly, can be applied almost anywhere along that signal chain, huh?
Absolutely. There's a place for it in every kind of part, in every kind of space within the production and distribution chain, even the CE devices on the back end. So that's one of the pieces of technology we'll talk about, is the upconversion. The other one that you mentioned, the distribution, is unique in and of itself, that offers significant features to broadcasters who either want to start streaming in HDR but still have to support the number of customers, the millions of people that still exist with standard dynamic range TVs. So we're able to take in high dynamic range content and distribute it to both HDR and SDR customers simultaneously through the exact same signal.
So it's a single stream of information, of data, that can be shown on an HDR display or an SDR display.
Correct. And as we change the ecosystem, this is going to be very important, because HDR content, HDR 10, for instance, open standard HDR content, does not look correct when it's on an SDR screen. So this is forcing everyone to have to make maybe two different versions of the content. If you're creating some other proprietary format, you'd have to create maybe a third version for that. But what we've
developed... nobody wants to do that, right? Nobody wants to... None of the studios want to create multiple versions of their content for different users, right?
It really depends. I mean, there's a certain limit, let's say, right? If I have standard dynamic range content, if I have high dynamic range content, I might want that level of control. But when you talk about creating proprietary methods of distribution, it makes it very, very difficult. You're making it just for a few outlets or a few screens or a few televisions in the home. It makes it very difficult for someone to justify the cost, the time, the effort, the talent that has to go in and supervise it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, on your website, it says, and I've heard it said many other places as well, that HDR is said to offer new tools for storytelling. And it also goes on to say that HDR sort of rewrites those rules. But my question is, how does it do that? What are the rules that, the new rules, I guess, that storytellers, movie makers, content creators can use HDR and tell a story that they couldn't have before?
It's a great question. It comes with a significant new challenge as we move into HDR. You have more color, you have more dynamic range, you have to decide what to do with it to distribute your luminance and your color palette throughout this new space. So imagine that you're a kid and you have a box of 12 crayons. You can only generate, you can only create a certain piece of art. But as you grow up, you're able to get the crayons with 64 crayons, or you're able to get 128.
I remember those boxes.
Make new designs, all new colors, all new pictures. Here, it's very much the same, even in another dimension, because we're able to get light that we haven't been able to get before. So it's, how do you tell a story? How do you show people walking up rocks within sunset while still maintaining the look and feel that the story was meant to tell? So it is a different way, and it is a tool to be used to help tell that creative story. There mm-hmm. are ways to overuse it, but most of the artists now are more on the conservative side, but also realizing that by opening up the luminance, they're able to really take advantage of the midtones and the low light shadow detail that they're able to bring into the image to tell the stories the way that they want to be told.
And we have a graphic number 4, which kind of, I think, is a side-by-side. Yeah, there we go. So go ahead.
Of course, it's really difficult on everyone's screen to be able to show what high dynamic
range. This is sort of only an indicator, because most people are looking at this on a standard dynamic range computer screen, or maybe TV, you know, with 709 color, which we'll get into in a minute. But still in all, it indicates sort of the difference. You see more detail in the clouds. The sun is brighter. The sky is bluer.
Exactly.
On the HDR side. Yeah.
Exactly. And of course, this is a simulated picture. I mean, I myself right now am looking at what I would consider an LDR screen, or a low dynamic range screen, on the the challenge is, how do you show somebody without showing somebody? And so these are simulated images, but once it's seen, once it's experienced, once you actually have that in front of you, as you would from any retail store, if you're able to go look at the different TVs while you're making your buying decisions, that seeing is really believing. Once you see it, there is no going back. It becomes very much like the transition was to HD, where when we transitioned to HD, anyone who went back to look at a standard definition signal realized that how poor the quality was compared to what they're able to receive today. And we see very much the same possibility and potential, and why people are really glomming onto HDR, because that impact is so much greater than what it was.
Isn't that interesting that the transition from standard definition to high definition was all about increasing the number of pixels, and wow, you could really see a difference. But now the transition from HD to Ultra HD, increasing the number of pixels doesn't make that much of an impact. But switching from standard dynamic range to high dynamic range, you can see that across the room. It's obvious.
Absolutely. It's a whole another dimension, a whole nother way. And of course, there's that law of diminishing returns in anything, as you're saying, with resolution. The same is true with brightness. There's sometimes a lot of talk about high dynamic range with brightness, but if you pay attention to what the term means, high dynamic range, it's about contrast. It's about the local contrast that you can have on a screen that can give you the perception of more detail, because what you're seeing is more sharpness. What you see is, as sharpness, is a combination of both resolution and contrast. And so here we're expanding in that other dimension. But on top of that, high dynamic range is now also including expanding the color gamut, which we can get into in a little bit, so that there are more colors on the extreme. And instead of just seeing a bright sky or a blue sky, you can now actually see a bright blue sky.
Right. You don't have to choose. Graphic 5 has this dimensionality that you're talking about, with the different dimensions of what we're... is that correct? I'm sorry, make it number 6. No, that's not it either. Where is... I thought we had a number 5. There it is. That's the one. I love this graphic. I've seen it a number of times, and I haven't really shown it on this show before, so... this is what you were talking about in terms of dimension. So tell us a little bit about this one.
Absolutely. So this is a pentagon that's showing you the 5 different dimensions of video, right? The 5 different dimensions that people are distributing to the home, the quality that can be improved. What you'll notice on the vertical axis, the spatial resolution, that's what you were talking about, that transition from standard definition to high definition to 4K. And the other dimensions are equally, if not more important, depending on the type of content you're dealing with. And if you look at the other axes, you see bit depth precision, where you have 8-bit, which is what everyone has been receiving to date, even on their Blu-rays, moving to 10-bit, because that's what the HEVC codec can support. You have in the other dimension across from that, frame rate. Frame rate may not change for cinema content, but within sports content, adding additional frames to the acquisition allows for smoother motion, which allows for higher temporal resolution that allows you to see sports like you're seeing them in person. Another dimension of seeing it more realistic is the combination of color and dynamic range. I bring these both together because as you expand luminance or as you move up in brightness or down deep into the shadows, it actually affects your perception of color. So both of these axes kind of affect on each other, but expanding these out within our transition to high dynamic range is important. So that internal pentagon is showing you what standard dynamic range was, and the outside is showing you what the Ultra HD premium specification announced by the UHD Alliance is for content.
And we should say that the innermost pentagon, polygon, it's not really a pentagon, but it is. It has five sides. No, that's all right. The innermost one is this light blue, and that is standard dynamic range with 8-bit precision and the color gamut that we have known for a long time. And the slightly darker one that's still inside the outer boundary of this diagram is what we're going to have coming up now in the high dynamic range. But it also indicates that there's yet more headroom, shall we say. There's still more room for the entire video system to grow even beyond what Ultra HD with high dynamic range currently is.
Correct. Right now, this is kind of, let's say, the benchmark for today, but there's absolutely more room to grow. And one of the exciting things about HDR is that ability to move it beyond. So what you'll notice, for instance, on the color volume axes is something labeled Rec 2020, which is actually even more colors. That's that move to the 128 crowns that I was talking about before. But right now, part of the limitation, the reason that we're not really in that space yet, and that even though we can carry it in that space, we're not really there, is because the screens can't display it. So no one can master to what they can't see. So here, we want to be able to see everything. We want our colorists, our artists, to be able to control every single color, every single pixel that they see. And if they can't see it, we don't know what's going to happen through the transmission phase. And effectively, it'll end up being something potentially completely different than you intended for it to be when it hits that final display.
Well, we've got a lot more to talk about. But before we do, I would like to take a moment to thank one of our sponsors for this episode, which is Epson. Now, Epson's revolutionary cartridge-free EcoTank line of printers for home and office introduce a new age in printing. The EcoTank ET4550 wireless all-in-one printer doesn't use ink cartridges. Instead, it features an amazing, innovative, refillable ink tank, earning it the title of CES 2016 Innovation Awards honoree. No more out-of-ink frustration. It includes up to 2 years of ink, equal to 11,000 black pages or 8,500 color pages. That means you can save up to 80% on ink with low-cost replacement bottles. It's also powered by Epson's Precision Core printing technology. It has auto two-sided printing and a 30-page auto document feeder, and easy wireless printing from tablets and smartphones. All EcoTank printers deliver an unbeatable combination of convenience and value. With Epson's EcoTank line of printers, you have the freedom to print without running out of ink. In fact, the Epson EcoTank system was named the 2016 Small Biz Windows Printer of the Year. So visit Epson.com/EcoTank today to transform the way your home, office, or work group prints. For the best combination of ease and value, turn to the Epson EcoTank printers. That's epson.com/EcoTank. And we thank Epson very much for their support. Epson, exceed your vision. So I'm talking with Josh L'Amour of Technicolor. And we're talking about HDR and what Technicolor is doing in that space, which turns out to be a heck of a lot. Let's start talking a little bit about content creation, since that's the beginning of the chain. Technicolor offers HDR grading services, you alluded to. My question here is, how do you deal, as a company that provides grading services, with the fact that different displays now have different capabilities? It used to be in standard dynamic range, you know, you mastered or graded for 100 nits peak brightness and 709 color space, color gamut, and that was all very well defined. Now you've got OLEDs that maybe reach 500 nits. You've got LCDs that maybe reach 1,000 nits. You've got different color capabilities. One display might do 85% of the current color gamut that we use in cinema, called P3. Another might do 90-some percent. Some might even go beyond that. So how do you, as a color grading service provider, deal with the fact that now you've got different capabilities, not only in consumer displays, but even in mastering displays?
Right. Absolutely a very pertinent question as we move into this new space. So one of the things that's very important when you're mastering is to master to the highest quality possible. That being said, we still master for standard dynamic range because it's still the mass market solution. It's still the ability for what everyone is going to see. So the colorist still wants to have full control over what that is. So typically within a workflow, the mastering process, we actually start with the cinema grade. We start with something that is in a P3 space to the 48-nit screen for cinema. And from there, from that kind of first grade, we remove what's called an output referred lookup table, put on another one for the standard dynamic range Rec 709, and then grade for that, do what we call a trim pass for that. Next, because we're now in this high dynamic range space, we would remove again the output referred lookup table for Rec 709, and we would move to an output referred lookup table for high dynamic range, and then do a trim pass for that. So each of these are kind of a different trim pass. And then depending on if you're using a proprietary technology trim pass, then that would be an additional one on top of that. And you can see how this can kind of start to escalate into multiple different versions. So our goal here really is to define what your mastering specification is, which we worked very heavily as one of the founding members of the UHD Alliance to define that for the industry, together with the studios, together with the television manufacturers around the world, and distribution companies and technology companies like ourselves, to work very heavily on what that specification would be. In doing that, we landed on a mastering display called from Sony called the X300, which is an OLED display, which has 1,000 nit peak luminance and goes all the way to a true zero black. That black's measured down to 4 decimal points. The reason I point that out and that we grade to an OLED display is it is the highest dynamic range possible grade. So there are displays out there that do, let's say, 4,000 nits, and people talk about numbers always being important. Well, a 4,000-nit display based on an LCD technology may actually be limited to only 133,000-to-1 contrast ratio, whereas grading on an OLED display with a 1,000-to-1 peak luminance actually gives us a greater than 10,000,000-to-1 contrast ratio. So here, in grading on that display, we actually create the highest dynamic range possible image, which displays in the home can't yet take advantage of. So yeah, by creating that, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, regarding the OLED, the X300, the Sony X300 OLED mastering monitor, which is beautiful. I've seen it. It's really amazing. But I would assume that you'd have to grade in a fairly dark room. And one of the things that people talk about in terms of high dynamic range, at least consumers, is, well, but I don't watch in a dark room. I watch in a, you know, room with some ambient light because, you know, grandma's knitting over in the corner, or the kids are playing or something, and I got to have light on in the room. So do you take that into account at all? Am I correct that you grade on this monitor in a really dark environment? It seems to me you'd have to.
You're absolutely correct. And actually, the same thing is true when we did standard dynamic range. We grade in a dark environment. So one of the reasons that consumer electronics TVs pushed the brightness higher and higher wasn't to make that ultra dynamic mode, really was to be able to take advantage of the content within a brighter environment. So if we grade to 100 nit Rec 709 in a dimly lit room and you go to a brighter room and that television is maybe a 300 nit, 400 nit TV with the same contrast ratio for SDR as our grading reference monitor, pushing up the luminance still gives you the content the way that it was meant to be seen. So we're still preserving the creative intent in a correct mode. If you move to dynamic mode, we know that that pushes it out saturation-wise, contrast-wise to the extremes. But if you're in a properly calibrated movie mode and maybe increase the backlight, you can actually maintain what was seen in that dark environment. The similar result is possible in high dynamic range. By grading to something that gives us that contrast ratio, as television manufacturers make brighter and brighter screens, the reason they're pushing it brighter and brighter is to allow for that kind of a room ambient light adaptation to take place, which is very key for the consumer environment. But we can't grade for every room. We can't grade for every screen. We grade to the best of our ability. And then as such, we have to grade on a monitor in a properly lit environment and recommend that if somebody wants to see it exactly as it was intended to be seen, they should review it in the same style environment.
Kind of a darker environment. Certainly video files like myself and many members of ABS Forum would agree. And they watch their TV, their movies, and so on in a darkened environment. But I have come to realize recently that we're probably in the minority.
Probably, unfortunately.
Yeah. Web 1969 is asking, do you think HEVC or H.265, the HEVC codec, will help with HDR deployment?
I think actually HEVC is going to be key to HDR deployment. Sorry, I'm getting a lot of reflection, and I apologize for the viewers. But HEVC is actually going to be the main codec that's going to carry high dynamic range going forward. So content will likely be encoded in that format. It's a higher efficiency codec, as by the name.
And high efficiency video codec is what HEVC stands for those of you who might not.
So in addition to that format being more highly efficient, it also moves us into a 10-bit world away from an 8-bit world. That 8-bit world was very limiting, let's say, for what we want within high dynamic range. We want to make sure that we don't have banding artifacts. We want to make sure we don't have quantization. So moving to high dynamic range, it's important to move to a 10-bit video codec, and HEVC offers that.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to try to point out the fact that we, when we were talking about that five-sided figure and the five different axes of variables in video transmission, there it is again. We talked about moving from 8-bit to 10-bit, but we didn't really say why that's important, and you just did. Because as you push the brightness higher, as you push the colors out to be more saturated, if you have only 8 bits to represent the brightness of any pixel at any given time, you might very well see banding, especially in things like sunsets and so on, or what's sometimes called quantization. You can see the step from level X to level X plus one or level X minus one. So with 10 bits, then that becomes much more smooth. The gradient becomes much more smooth and it looks more natural. I know Joe Kane and some other serious video guys would even advocate for 12 bits or more, but then that becomes pretty expensive, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So part of the challenge with 12-bit is it actually forces the industry to move to a dual layer approach as it stands right now, because there is no real standardization for a 12-bit video codec at this moment. And even just moving chipsets to decoding for 10-bit has been difficult. So there are, let's say, some confounding information in the marketplace about if something is 10-bit or 12-bit. And you really need to pay attention to what the video codec is that's carrying that information to understand where the limitations are as far as bit depth.
Mm-hmm. That dual layer approach, one of them anyway, is Dolby Vision, which is that along with the open standard HDR10 are the two sort of main high dynamic range formats or systems, if you will, that are out in the market now. Interestingly, Dolby Vision is mostly used with streaming content, although there is some HDR10 as well. And HDR10, though, predominates on Ultra HD Blu-ray discs, at least so far. Which leads me to the question, you make a lot of discs, over 1 million, 5 million last year or something?
More like almost 1 billion, but yes.
1 billion. Oh my God. Yes. Okay. so the question is, none of the Ultra HD discs that have been released so far have Dolby Vision. They only have HDR10. Do you in your longer view of the industry, do you see Dolby Vision coming to physical media anytime soon or not?
I mean, it absolutely is possible. Dolby and even there is a Technicolor technology that's part of the Blu-ray, Ultra HD Blu-ray specification. Both of those are possible to come to the market. Right now, even on streaming, one thing to point out is predominantly the content that is being put into the marketplace actually is HDR10, not Dolby Vision. There are a few titles in Dolby Vision, but the majority of the content that's out there is actually in the open HDR format. So that's true for both Blu-ray and streaming.
Yeah. Well, Vudu, I know, streams mostly Dolby Vision. Netflix, I think, does both. Amazon, I think, does both. So yeah, you're right. It's probably majority of this open standard. Although Dolby Vision does give you 12-bit resolution, ultimately. It gets downshifted to 10 bits finally at the very end, but you do have 12 bits, I guess, in the pipeline, don't you?
So it's a very interesting question. This goes back to kind of the potential of confounded information, let's say, in the marketplace. Mm, mm.
And that's the point. That's the point of this show, is trying to deconfound people.
Absolutely, and happy to help. In the mastering process, we actually more than likely will use a 16-bit codec for features or for major television shows. For typical broadcast, we use a 12-bit codec, no matter what HDR format is that's being created. And then it really just goes down to whatever the distribution format is. If the distribution is an HEVC, then it's a 10-bit distribution, unless it's a dual-layer approach. We, Technicolor, being an open standards company, we actually grade both open HDR as well as Dolby Vision content. So I can confidently say workflows on both sides. I understand them both. And again, the majority of the content for Amazon and now also for Netflix is being graded through our facilities through similar workflows.
Radio Rod in the chat room has a suggestion. Use splines when remastering 8-bit color to 10 or 12-bit to eliminate banding. I don't know what a spline is. Do you?
Unfortunately, I'm not sure what's meant by a spline, but I do know, for instance, a lot of what happens is dithering to be able to create, to control some of the banding artifacts, which effectively, ironically, is adding noise and then removing it to smooth out banding artifacts. And so some
of
that
strange
the up conversion process.
Right. Although I'm sure you have to do it because you, as you said, you're working in 16-bit internally in the mastering process, in the workflow as files are moving back and forth. They eventually have to end up 10-bit, right?
Correct. And again, it really depends on the workflow. It depends on the budget. It depends on a lot of different factors for what you're working within. But within a grading system itself, once you've loaded in the material, typically you're working in a floating point space. But ultimately, it really depends on what the mastering or mezzanine spec is for delivery to what they're getting before they do their HEVC compression.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if Radio Rod comes back with what splines are. He may at some point, in which case we'll talk about it. Next, though, what I really would like to talk about is something we mentioned earlier called ITM, or now I've forgotten what it is.
Intelligent Tone Management.
Intelligent Tone Management. Yes, indeed. And there's a lot to say about it. So before we do, because I don't want to interrupt us while we're starting to talk about that, let me thank our other sponsor for this episode, which is Corning. Now, Corning can greatly improve your audio-video workflow, speaking of workflows, with their strong, durable, and far-reaching Thunderbolt and USB 3.0 fiber optic cables. Whether you're into high-end video, photography, audio production, or computing, Corning's optical cables allow you to build a convenient workspace through a superior long-distance connection. Corning's USB 3.0 and Thunderbolt cables are incredibly strong and flexible. They have exceptional cable runs of up to 60 meters or 200 feet for Thunderbolt and 50 meters or 165 feet for USB 3, making it so easy to move noisy, space-consuming devices away from your workspace. Corning's cables are even hot swappable, and you can daisy chain up to 6 Thunderbolt devices. You can also bend or walk on Corning's ultra slim cables, and even if they're tangled, they still keep transmitting at top speed. Now, one of the coolest testimonials I've seen for Corning optical cables comes from Universal Audio, which is a maker of very high-end audio interfaces and professional audio gear, which I used to write about when I was covering Pro Audio. Universal Audio relies on optical cables by Corning to achieve acoustic isolation in their studio, where they test new equipment, such as their best-selling Thunderbolt audio interfaces. Instead of investing in multiple extenders, adapters, and cables, turn to Corning to establish the connection you need with one simple long-length cable. Corning's products are available at all major electronics and professional AV retailers, including Apple stores, Amazon, B&H, and more. Corning's cables are longer, thinner, lighter, and stronger. Go to corning.com/twit to save up to $130 on Thunderbolt optical cables. This promotion is valid only till August 31st or while supplies last, whichever occurs first. Just go to corning.com/twit to save on their unbeatable Thunderbolt cables. And we thank Corning very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks. So we're about to start talking about intelligent tone management. And this is a critical aspect of high dynamic range. Tone management. Well, tell us, first of all, what is tone management? What does that term mean?
The pentagon, the polygon that we showed you that has all those different axes and dimensions. As we start to move within the luminance space, as we start to move within the color space, whether up or down between high dynamic range and standard dynamic range, you end up having to really manage the balance between the different gamut and the different luminance. The combination of these two, the saturation, the hue, it's very important because it does shift if you don't manage it appropriately.
And as we said, now we have TVs of differing capabilities, and we have a lot of content going out that's still going to be on standard dynamic range displays. So we need to manage how particularly the color and the luminance are managed or mapped so that it looks as good as possible on any display, right?
Absolutely. And specifically, the intelligent tone management is because the ecosystem currently exists with standard dynamic range content. While you mentioned, there's a majority of high dynamic range content as open HDR, there's some titles out there as Dolby Vision. There's millions and millions of hours of content, of good content, that's in standard dynamic range. And as we went through the transition to high definition and everyone remastered content for high definition, re-released content so people could experience it in new, amazing ways, the same is going to be true for high dynamic range. So one of the aspects of intelligent tone management is the ability to allow people to remaster content, the ability for people to go in and when they release a new title, be able to create the other 6 in the series that already existed, let's say, and remaster those into high dynamic range.
I'm going to go out a little bit out of order on the graphics here, and I'm going to ask Alex to pull up number 7 because that addresses the point you just made, which is, there could be all kinds of different content, and it all gets fed in here and dealt with. Tell us what we're looking at here.
So this very complex picture actually just demonstrates the kind of ecosystem that we're looking at. What you'll see on the left is different types of content with different types of curves. Typically, what you'll see in the yellow, that's our standard dynamic range content. So, of course, if I have standard dynamic range content, I have to feed that into the ecosystem. What you'll see on the top, labeled basketball, is S-Log3 content. S-Log3 is a high dynamic range proprietary space in Sony professional equipment. So that is going to feed into this ecosystem. You have PQ content, which is what a lot of people refer to as HDR10. You even have HLG, which is a new curve, a new EOTF that's been proposed by BBC and NHK. So you have all this different variety of content that's going to exist that have to feed into the ecosystem for a multiple, for a world with multiple different types of displays. And that's the world that you see on the right. So this is an example of how a set-top box may be connected to any of these TVs. You might have it connected to a TV that's identified as a UHD premium under the guidance of the UHD Alliance. You might have a TV that just understands HLG content. You might have a TV that just understands HDR10 or even 2.4 gamma SDR, with, or sorry, 2.4 gamma HDR, which some of the, let's say, cheaper televisions actually use. And more than likely, you're going to have a TV or a display device that's standard dynamic range because that's what we all own today.
Right. Most of us.
Exactly. So this and the other point to point out there is even if you have a standard dynamic range TV in your living room, if you go out and buy a high dynamic range TV, I don't know a single person who's going to go away and throw away their standard dynamic range TV. They're going to move it to another room in the yep. house. Still going to have to yep. feed that other TV with standard dynamic range content. Mm-hmm. So this diagram shows, and you'll see presented in Technicolor HDR, this shows our Technicolor HDR distribution technology and how it's able to bring in every single type of content that will be out there because it's at its heart EOTF agnostic or curve agnostic. And it's able to take in any content and distribute it appropriately to any kind of TV. This is just showing you the set-top box example because, as I mentioned before, we're the second largest manufacturer of set-top boxes. But the same technology, the same decode technology exists on the television side, which allows these high dynamic range TVs to take advantage of content that's been presented in Technicolor HDR.
Mm-hmm. Now, I just want to make sure everybody understands that EOTF stands for Electro-Optical Transfer Function, and it's basically the curve that determines when a TV or a set-top box or something gets a brightness value, how much light will it put out? And there are several choices. There's one choice in standard dynamic range. It's called gamma. And I'm kind of surprised to hear that there are TVs, high dynamic range TVs, that actually still use gamma. I thought that was pretty strictly a standard dynamic range thing. But you're saying there might be some that do both or that do gamma.
Yeah, definitely the very first ones that came out, which actually came out in 2014, did 2.4 gamma for HDR because there wasn't a different curve. They still look great. They still were able to show high dynamic range. But as we move into high dynamic range, there are these different curves, different ways to, as you said, appropriately communicate what value gets what value of brightness on TV. And that ecosystem is very mixed. It's mixed on the content creation side. It's mixed on the display side. And so there's this need for a technology that can help to simplify the interoperability problem that we're running into.
Mm-hmm. And again, just for those who might not be familiar or aware, the most common curve, EOTF curve that we're seeing so far today is called PQ, Perceptual Quantizer. It's used in HDR10, the open standard, and in Dolby Vision. But now, BBC and NHK, BBC in England, NHK in Japan, have come up with this other one called HLG, Hybrid Log Gamma, which basically combines kind of gamma and PQ-ish into a curve that could be used. And then there's the Sony one, which is used in their cameras when they capture something, which is actually an OETF, optoelectrical transfer function. It's changing light coming into the lens into a digital signal. Is called S-Log3. We might see some TVs with HLG. I suppose that's possible. I'm not sure we would see them in S-Log3. Josh, what do you think? Is that even possible?
It is possible. It's probably not probable. The S-Log3 format, the reason it's important is it's a production space. Similar to how with film we had negative, which was optimized for the exposure, capturing as much latitude as possible, and then that would be a space you would work within. These log spaces allow for much more detailed work optimized towards the camera sensor, and there's a reason to work within that space. So Sony's been promoting people to work within that space and then convert to the output that they're looking for distribution. Whether that's, let's say, PQ or HLG or our Technicolor HDR distribution format, which actually allows you to sample at a higher bit precision and then distribute it in a form that's compatible with HEVC. So different ways to get to the same end location, but you end up with a higher quality if you end up with a path that allows you to maintain more bits through it.
Right. I wanted you to tell us a little bit more about intelligent tone management, and there's a graphic that we have for that as well, number six. And this, I think, kind of explains how it works. Tell us about it.
Absolutely. So it is an oversimplification, but it is a way for you to kind of understand how we can break down an image and reintroduce details. So typically, the intelligent tone management will take in a standard dynamic range picture, your home video master, your Rec 709 2.4 gamma image.
Like the one on the left here in this picture.
Correct. The one labeled input image. It will break it down into components, which is actually analyzing in real time. We can do this up to 4K P60 right now.
Wow.
The reason being, and the reason we focus up to that kind of a threshold is because we also deploy this not just in grading suites, but also in a live production environments for sports. So taking in that standard.
So it has to be done in real time.
Absolutely. It has to be done in real time. It has to be done efficiently, and it has to not have any hiccups or drops. Otherwise, it would obviously destroy the integrity of the program. So in real time, we can take in that image, analyze the detail in the image, the color, the luminance distribution, and upconvert it to high dynamic range, which, again, another place that only seeing is believing, because a lot of people question, how can you possibly do that? How can you introduce more detail when I can't see it? The algorithms we developed actually are very good at picking up on subtleties and expanding them in an extremely natural way, because it's not just affecting a luminance in an absolute way as a lookup table would. It is affecting it algorithmically, context aware of every single pixel around every single pixel. So that way it's creating natural roll-offs. It's creating natural transitions to the rest of the image where appropriate to give you an expansion that is natural, to create fluffiness in clouds, for instance, that you're never able to see, or to give you back detail in brush that you might not have lost in the standard dynamic range version.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, obviously a lot of video files like myself eschew sharpness controls or detail enhancement because it often looks very artificial. But I suspect that what you're doing here is much more sophisticated than that and likely to produce a much more natural looking effect, which is obviously, as you just said, the goal.
Absolutely. And it's one of the reasons that right now several real live trials have been going on together with us with the different sports outlets that are doing in real time up conversion. One of the challenges to creating an HDR ecosystem is everyone just spent money on 4K infrastructure, or everyone just spent money on HD infrastructure, and they're being told, good news, throw out that $30 million you just spent and buy all Obviously, that's not possible. Obviously, that's a huge expense that can't happen for a long time. So offering technology that allows the transition phase allows them to start taking advantage of high dynamic range, presenting images that look great, but aren't quite at the level, let's say, of native acquisition. But they can go ahead and start producing and distributing that content now as opposed to waiting till later.
So you're talking about actually capturing in standard dynamic range, applying this intelligent tone management to create an effectively a high dynamic range image. Might not be quite as good as natively captured high dynamic range, but it'll still be better than standard dynamic range.
Correct. And bear in mind, it's not just the cameras that have to change when you're talking about a live production. All the archival material that exists is going to be captured in standard dynamic range, so that has to be added into the program. The graphics are typically generated in standard dynamic range, so those now need to be upconverted. Interstitials, all the commercial work, everything that you're adding into a program, all the complexity that goes into it today, happens in standard dynamic range. So unless all of that changes immediately, all at once, it's very difficult to move into high dynamic range. So you can see all these different points may at one time or another need the ability to upconvert in a natural way, be able to marry together with native high dynamic range content in the same program.
You said you're working with some outlets that are doing sports. Is this being used at all in the Olympics that are just starting today?
So the Olympics, as you know, are going to be in high dynamic range. They will have
One piece. The only piece I know of that's going to be in high dynamic range is the opening ceremony, which is happening as we speak.
Correct. So the opening ceremonies are in high dynamic range. They have several cameras that are native, several cameras that may need to be upconverted because they're taking in feeds from NHK's 8K broadcast. They're down converting that to, or down sampling that to 4K, and then they would have to do some way to marry that together with high dynamic range. So definitely the necessity exists for conversion between standard dynamic range and high dynamic range for certain angles. Otherwise, you won't get the typical coverage that you would get within a stadium.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's an experiment at this point, I'm sure, and it's only that one event at the games that is being done in high dynamic range. And of the four outlets that are carrying the 4K or Ultra HD signal that's being captured mostly by NHK and I guess it's what's it called, Olympic sports broadcasting, something like that. Only Comcast is showing it in actual high dynamic range, not even on their set-top boxes, which is one reason I asked you about the XI-5 earlier, but only through their app on Samsung TVs. So we're at the very early stages of this, but I'm heartened to see it happening at all.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very, very early stages of all of this, but we, together with the ecosystem, continue to grow, continue to learn, continue to develop what's necessary to make it happen. And as you said, the outlets may not be there yet, but all the technology, all the workflow is being established. It's being tested. We've been doing some work on other sports as well, which is very interesting. And when you see sports in high dynamic range, it really becomes something that's almost intangible to explain. It's almost like sitting courtside. It's almost like sitting, next to the players as they're hitting the baseball. It's really incredible the amount of detail you can get out, even in upconverted content, that makes it a whole new type of experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can't wait for more of that to happen. I might actually become interested in sports if that happens, when that happens, because I'm not particularly now, but I certainly would watch it for that, for the same reason I sometimes go to movies in Dolby Cinemas, not because I'm necessarily interested in the movie per se, but I want to study how the high dynamic range looks. And that's really, for now, the best experience you can get in a commercial cinema, even better than most home theaters at this point. That will change at Cedia this year. In September, it's only next month. Good God. We will probably see some very interesting developments there. Are you going to Cedia, by the way? Is that a show you pay attention to?
I'm not in September. There are three other shows I'll be at the same time.
Yeah. All right.
So keep me traveling quite a bit, but, September seems to be a busy month for everyone. I don't know why.
Yeah, I think so. Well, because everyone's back from vacation, I guess, or something like that.
Probably.
Let's take a look at graphic number 8 here as we come to the end of our discussion. I just want to make sure to show this because this is another really good one. Tell us what we're looking at here.
When we looked at the ecosystem and we talked about distribution a little bit, the reality, again, still exists that the distribution itself on a single channel will actually be an intermix of HDR and SDR content. As such, you have to pay attention to things like MVPDs or redistribution that's happening of signals, where if you, even if you are trying to protect, do everything in the right way, you may end up with a local distributor who inserts ads that are standard dynamic range. So ITM, that same core functionality that we developed for colorists to do remastering, for sports to be able to do broadcasting in HDR right now, we actually developed into silicon that can be implemented in devices to ensure that consumers are always getting an HDR experience. This is very different than a dynamic mode. The purpose of this really is to complement high dynamic range content, preserve the SDR so that the TV doesn't do fluctuations in luminance and backlight because it's receiving different kinds of content, that it can receive a normalized HDR feed at all times and ensure that the consumer isn't concerned that the TV has issues. Because what will happen is one of two things on the TV side if they don't have a technology that helps to balance it out. Either the TV will go between a mode where it dims down to standard dynamic range levels every time a standard dynamic range piece of content comes on, and then ramps up when a high dynamic range piece of content comes on.
Man, that would be distracting.
Exactly. And in addition to that, or alternatively to that, the TV may just jump in and out of dynamic mode at these specific points to try and equalize it. So here we're trying to maintain the look and feel so that to the consumer who's watching the content, they don't get distracted by a white background of a standard dynamic range piece of content in a commercial that ends up going to the peak brightness of their TV, which would obviously be extremely egregious.
Mm-hmm. So this ITM can be applied at the consumer end in a set-top box or even in a TV. How's the deployment of that going? I mean, it's early days still, I'm sure, but...
As you said, it's early days for a lot of the TVs. What you'll be seeing is a lot more of us in both the upconversion technology and our distribution technology starting over the next several months leading up to CES 2017. So keep an eye out. Look out for Technicolor, who has been heavily involved with all these different people who are working on content, because we've recognized the problems. We've worked on those problems, and we're helping people to solve those problems to create better high dynamic range devices going forward.
Well, I'm sure looking forward to it. From what I've seen of the demos at various shows and so on, Technicolor is obviously very deeply involved in making sure that what we, the consumers, end up seeing at the end of the chain is as good as possible and as consistent as possible, as you just were talking about there. And I really, really appreciate that. I think that's excellent work, and I applaud you for doing it.
Thank you.
So we've come to the end. How can you believe it? I mean, the hour just goes by like that, doesn't it?
that was extremely quick. And thank you very much. It's wonderful.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for being here. That's Josh Lamour, VP of Technology and Ecosystem Development at Technicolor. And you can find out more, of course, at technicolor.com. Josh, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much, Scott. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
You can find me, of course, at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott and at avsforum. You can also find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/htg and on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twithometheatergeeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Tim Hoganacker. I'll get that right by the time the show comes along. He's a remixing engineer, and he's been working on a lot of Dolby Atmos encoded Blu-rays. In fact, he is said to have worked on some 30% of the 100 or so titles that are out now. So I'm going to be talking with him about remixing Atmos for the home. Should be fascinating, and I do hope you will join me. Until then, geek out.